in trouble.
It's going to get there. He turned 32 yesterday. Does he have a vintage moment in it? In the end zone, it is caught for the win. Richard Rodgers with a walk-off touchdown. A game ender for the Packers.
Welcome to the Glass Half Empty podcast on the Big Lead. I'm Ryan Glasspiegel. We're joined by Matt Vasgersian, who is going to be calling the NL wildcard game on Tuesday on ESPN alongside Alex Rodriguez and Jessica Mendoza. As we sit here taping on Wednesday, September 26th, there are still five teams that might be in that game, which is now the Brewers, the Cubs, the Cardinals, the Dodgers, and or the Rockies. That's about all you can hope for in a baseball season, right? Like four games to play, five games to play, and there's still a ton that's left to be decided.
It's true. And you know what? I would say this too, Ryan. Like beyond that, there are a lot of us who kind of root for chaos. I'm among them. And if I were to get my wish, we would have some permutation where there is a tie atop the wild card, atop the West, atop the Central. And then that would require a play-in game, which would be awesome before the play-in game, which is the wild card game. So I'd love it if there was a game on Monday to determine a tiebreaker. And just let's just keep those one-game elimination scenarios coming one after another.
I'm not even sure how the rights work for the play-in game. Does that go to the local broadcasters, or does ESPN have rights for any of those potentially?
I could be wrong about this, so I'm going to roll the dice here, and I think it depends on which league gets which game. So in other words, if there's a tie that would affect the National League wildcard, it's the National League wildcard rights holder that year, which is ESPN this year, would have that game. Same true if there's an American League tie, it would go to whoever has the American League wildcard game, TBS. That's my understanding. I'm not sure if they're exclusive, so maybe the locals could be on the air at the same time. But yeah, those are all things we root for, in part because we don't know the answers to these questions.
Yeah, it's really crazy because I'm a Brewers fan living in Chicago, and the Brewers, all of a sudden, it was a really strange year because they were leading by a lot in April, May, June. They struggled going into the All-Star break, and since then, the Cubs have been leading, and now all of a sudden, the Brewers are half game back, and I'm looking at both of these teams, and I think I'm looking at it objectively, but it seems like top to bottom, the Brewers are better. And I'm wondering like how the Cubs are even ahead of them at this point. And as you said, it's just like straight up chaos going into the end of the season. So I guess you're not going to answer what matchup you want to see, but I know that some of your bosses wouldn't mind the Brewers winning the division and the Cubs being in that game from a viewership perspective.
Yeah. That's, that's the understandable kind of response from somebody who's in the office, who's looking at bottom lines and numbers. I'll tell you this. I mean, you're right in that I don't really have any skin in the game, and I don't really care. Like, I mean, it's going to be a great game regardless. I'll say this, maybe I'm a little partial from my days of working in Milwaukee, but I think that atmosphere would be absolutely rabid for a wild card host. I think the same thing could be true of Denver if the Rockies host the wild card game. And that's not to say that there wouldn't be a great atmosphere in St. Louis or Chicago or LA. There would. But those two markets, for me, seem to be a little more postseason starved. And the idea of having a postseason game in your ballpark, one where you win and advance, I just think that people in those places in Denver and Milwaukee would go crazy for that kind of event in their town. And I know that I think a lot of my colleagues feel the same way. But again, there's no wrong answer and there's no bad outcome to this.
You mentioned your time in Milwaukee. And so when you got there, you were in your late 20s. You'd spent, as a lot of announcers who call play-by-play do, you'd spent a lot of your 20s kind of toiling around the minor leagues. Was there ever a time where you, during this period, where you hadn't gotten in the majors yet and you wondered if there was ever going to be a future in this industry? And if so, what was something that convinced you to persevere through it?
Yeah, you know, there are many of those moments because, look, we're all impatient when we're in our 20s. And whether you were in your 20s, you know, back in the 1960s or 70s, or if you were in your 20s now, I think that's just one of the character traits for people at that time date stamp. You're impatient. I was no different. Once I figured out that it was something that was doable, and you never really dreamt of anything on a grand scale, you just thought, you know, I could do Major League Baseball. I could work for a team. You hear what else is out there, and you know you're working hard, you think you're doing okay, you think you're improving. I think it was probably for me when I got to Tucson. That was my last minor league destination, and it happened to be a place that I really liked. I liked living there. I liked the people that I worked with, and I was willing to give it one more year past the 1996 season. If big league baseball hadn't happened when it did for me, I would have worked one more year as the radio voice of the Tucson Toros, and then I may have pursued something different within the industry, maybe radio talk, maybe TV anchoring, maybe even would have tackled another game, another sport, even though baseball's always been my best girl. I had another year in for sure, maybe one more, but I would say that the recommended route is not how I did it. I mean, I was exceedingly fortunate to only spend 6 years working in the minors and then get a job in the big leagues. And if it hadn't been that team, that city, those people in charge of the Brewers in 1997, I don't know that I would have gotten a major league job. They're pretty impacted, as everybody knows. There's only a few jobs with each team, and those don't turn over very often. So looking back, I am just as grateful now as I was then that phone rang when it did, telling me that I'd gotten the job in Milwaukee. And I still kind of pinch myself that it even did happen that way. I was fully prepared to not get a big league job.
Has there been a time in your career, either through the minors or since through today, where you were a runner-up for a job that you really wanted, but you didn't get it, and now you're having kind of a Darius Rucker moment, like, thank God for all I missed because it led me here to this?
That's good. I'm going to steal that from you very soon.
Do it. I'll be flat. Yeah, you know, don't even have to attribute me.
Okay. I'm a good attributor, but if you say I don't need to, I'll do that. You know, it's funny you say that because the year before I got the TV job in Milwaukee, I was a finalist for the radio job in Milwaukee. And, you know, not that I'm glad I didn't get that job, because it's a great job and I was super disappointed when I didn't get it. But as it turns out, I got to work for the same team, and back in 1997, I wasn't doing as many games as the radio guys were because the TV package was really small. I think we did 69 games or 70 games that year. But I got the job anyway with the Brewers, and things worked out great for me. I'm grateful. But yeah, the job, my kind of near miss job, was the same team a year earlier on a different medium.
You would have been working with Euchre, which would have been really special, but still, there's obviously a difference in stature between radio and television.
Yeah, I mean, there is, only because I guess there is. I still consider baseball a radio game, even though, you know, the radio animal as we knew it back in the day, and as I used to be a consumer of it in a rabid sense, it's different now. You know, I grew up in Northern California in the 70s when the Oakland A's weren't on TV at all. And what you had was the radio. And I listened to A's games on the radio regularly. regardless of whether they're playing in the Pacific time zone or not. It's different now. People are consuming the game and sports, I mean, heaven knows, so much differently than they were 40 plus years ago.
You mentioned listening to the A's on the radio. As you embarked on this path, who was the broadcaster or the broadcasters that you aspired to be like one day on your ultimate trajectory?
Well, just, you know, being kind of a homer from the area and a kid that grew up loving the A's, the Raiders, and the Warriors, Bill King was my hero as a kid in terms of sports play-by-play, and in fact was the only one that I had ever really heard or been familiar with, other than the occasion when I would, you know, bounce over to listen to a Giants game, which was pretty infrequent for me as a kid. Bill King was a man of all seasons. He was eloquent. He was excitable. He was colorful, and he was the guy that I kind of thought maybe was in place as a role model for me. Interestingly, though, or maybe not so interestingly for some, but when I listen back, and I still have a handful of my first ever tapes that I did with the Huntington Cubs, a now defunct team from the Appalachian League, and it was in 1991, I think, was when I started there. For whatever reason, I'm kind of channeling Tom Meese, the late SportsCenter anchor, and I'm my cadence, my voice, it's like that guy, Tom Meese, made a bigger impact on me than I thought. And that's kind of who I was doing in my first year. And, you know, that's what we all do when we're young broadcasters and we're just starting. Whether you know you're doing it or not, there's something in your brain and you're just kind of mimicking what you think a sportscaster or a baseball play-by-play guy should sound like. And when you get good, and this is true of all of us, when you get good at it, it's when your own voice comes out and you're not doing that anymore. But it's such a common, you know, first or second year mistake that, dare I say, every single one of us have done that at some point.
What's the most valuable piece of feedback you've received in your career?
Oh, man. Gosh, there's so much. You know, I guess, you know, it sounds really cliche and it kind of piggybacks on what I just said, but the be yourself mantra really is the only choice that you have. There are still people working that you listen to that you can kind of hear the uncomfortableness in their cadence, in their presentation. You have to be comfortable with yourself before anybody's comfortable listening to you. And so if you're panicky, if you're doing a character, if you're scared, it's just not going to work. And, you know, I had that experience really personified to the nth degree when I took the leap of faith and did the XFL in 2001. Looking back on it, I'm really glad I did it. I grew a lot from it. And the advice that I got then was really advice that I gave myself afterwards, which is, don't sign off on anybody else's sensibilities ever again unless you share them. So when somebody tells you, hey, it's going to be this way and it's going to be that way and it's going to work, and something inside you knows that that's wrong, listen to your gut. Again, all that sounds cliche, but through my experiences, I found it to be completely accurate.
I wanted to talk about the XFL with you, so I'm glad you brought that up. It sounds like you had to lend your sensibility to the league, which I think everybody who's ever worked as a broadcaster for Vince McMahon has had to adjust his or her sensibility, because Vince is somebody who knows exactly what he wants and demands it out of you. So what is a great Vince McMahon behind the scenes story from that now we know ill-fated season?
Well, you know, I don't have any real dirt to dish on Vince, because he was always real upfront with me. He didn't think I was the right guy for that, and he was probably right. But, you know, the one thing I learned in kind of just shadowing Vince for a little while, which I did prior to the first week of coverage, And I thought that was interesting too, because I was dying to get information on the players, because unless you had access to every, you know, junior college media guide from 5 years ago, you didn't know who the players in the XFL were. They were guys that were pretty anonymous. There weren't the kind of websites dedicated to, you know, bios of pro and semi-pro athletes as there are today. And we didn't know who these dudes were, but instead of prepping myself that way, NBC felt like it was important for me to be with Vince and learn how Vince operates. So I traveled with the then WWF between Pittsburgh and Cleveland, I believe it was, to watch a couple shows. And I learned in very short order that if Vince gives you feedback and it's not the next thing that you do, you are persona non grata for a little while. He sits right behind the curtain where the performers enter and exit. I believe they call it the gorilla position. Yep. So you know this world probably better than I do, Ryan, but he sits there and he's got a huge set of keys in front of him, and he can open up anybody's ear at any time during the production and say, more fireworks, less light, more air conditioning. Hey, tell Triple H that I want him to flip his hair a couple times. Like he is puppeteering this entire massive grand scale orchestra. And every one of the performers that finishes their match and exits through the gorilla, they make eye contact with Vince. And it's almost like he's the executioner. Like he's giving them thumbs up and thumbs downs. If he gives you an approving look and a thumbs up, man, those performers would fly into the dressing room loving life. If he gave you that kind of squinty Cheshire Cat eye, like, you kind of missed this, that, and the other, those guys would kind of sink back knowing that there was a conversation with the boss coming in the next hour or two. It was an eye-opening experience, not for better, not for worse. I enjoyed it, but I was not prepared to sell the XFL on the air the way Vince wanted it sold.
What was it like working with Jesse Ventura? Because I saw you told Neil Best of Newsday that Ventura did not really give you a ton of communication in terms of working with you as a partner.
He was certainly pleasant. He enjoyed himself. I mean, it still befuddles me that an acting state governor could pull himself away from the business of his constituents to get on a plane and go to Orlando to announce a cartoon football game once a week. It's still hilarious to me that that happened. But he was easy to work with. He was a nice guy. I mean, I recall before the season started, just to get to know him, Bill Bunnell, who was the producer, who's gone on to much bigger and better things with college football at ESPN. Bill and I went to the governor's mansion in Minneapolis. It might have been in St. Paul, but we went to Minnesota, went into the governor's mansion, had dinner with the governor of Minnesota, who was a guy that used to be a wrestler. You know, it was awesome. He was easy to work with and very cool. And I think he was supportive of my coming back to the booth when ultimately it happened. He kind of made fun of the line Vince gave me when he said I needed more seasoning when I was demoted to the videotape crew. I liked Jesse. It didn't work out really for anybody that anybody came out of that smelling very good. But my experiences with everybody were pleasant.
So I wanted to talk to you about the booth with A-Rod and Jessica Mendoza. What do you think has been the biggest improvement in the chemistry or the cadence or anything of that nature between when you guys first tested together and today?
Well, I think, you know, we were comfortable with each other from the jump. We liked each other. Like anything, the more you're with someone you like, the more time you spend with people who you like initially, the better it's supposed to get. And so our ease with each other has increased. Alex's comfort with the medium has increased, and it was a really sharp learning curve for him because he's a quick study. But really, initially, I mean, things like, you know, using the talk back button to talk to the producer and ask for certain shots or replays or even ask a question. He was not completely locked in on that early, which you'd expect from a guy who had done two games in his life. But he, you know, he's gotten so much more comfortable with that. And along with being more comfortable mechanically, you know, that allows your editorial side to come out a lot easier. And we've seen that for sure. I mean, by midseason, Alex was comfortable enough to point out what he thought were things wrong with everything from players who were injured and not participating, such as the discussion that he had regarding Yu Darvish in the middle of the season, to propping up players that he thought were underappreciated, criticizing front office philosophy. He's been super, super honest with how he feels about that stuff.
He had a
run. I think it plays really well. I wouldn't really call it a run in, to be honest. You know, Alex was critical of Yu Darvish. Madden protected his player, which is what he's supposed to do. And they had a discussion about it the next time they saw one another, which was inevitable. So they kind of agreed to disagree, but they were polite with each other, and it wasn't, there was no acrimony there. And afterwards they exchanged text messages, and I think they both felt pretty good about where their relationship was at that moment. But Alex was firm in his stance. Joe was firm in protecting his players, and both teams did what they were supposed to do, I thought. But, you know, our vibe has gotten better each week. We liked each other to begin with, and we like each other now. And that's so much of it, man. It sounds cliche and kind of, I don't know, it sounds like I'm just making stuff up. But you wouldn't be surprised, Ryan, because you work in the business and you cover this stuff. But there are a lot of booths in sports where the announce crew or a producer, director team or whatever, where there isn't that camaraderie, where they're just strictly just working together and they don't really like each other that much. That is not true of our group. And I think one of the things that I like to watch as a viewer is people enjoying themselves together on TV. I watch fantasy football now every Sunday at 11 a.m. I think it's even on earlier now. And one of the things I like the most about that show is that they like each other. They get to the information. They tell me who I should start and who I should sit, who I should look for on the waiver wire. But they do it in a really warm way that I like to watch. You don't want to be preached to. You don't want to watch mechanical people going through the motions, trying to be experts and outdo one another at every turn. You like to watch people that are enjoying each other. And that's what we're trying to do. And I hope that's what we've accomplished.
It's kind of like that, the line in Fight Club where he says, when people think you're dying, they actually listen to you instead of waiting for their turn to speak.
I never thought of it that way, but okay, yeah. Okay. That's a pretty good application of that quote. I'll buy it.
A-Rod's obviously been very famous for a very long time. He's had his ups and his downs. What is something about A-Rod, the human being, that would surprise people who only know him as this avatar of a baseball player and broadcaster in the public limelight?
He is an extremely kind-hearted guy. And, you know, at risk of deflating some of the, you know, the Herculean images that fans might have about an athlete who's at the very top of his profession and one of the best to ever play. He's a warm person he's got a big heart. He's gracious to people. I know for a fact he is really locked in as a dad. He's a guy that wants to make the rest of his life, as right and good and contributing as it possibly can be. And he knows that he's in a special place to do that because of what he's earned, both in status and monetarily. And he wants to make a difference that way. He really is a good guy. And it kind of bugs you when you hear people take shots or whatever. I mean, I get it, like the whole A-Rod is a Yankee image and all of his Page Six Babylon that came along with it. I get it that people perceive huge sports figures based on a Twitter line or what they see at the top of their Yahoo news feed. But I'm here to tell you that he's a good guy and he's a caring guy, and I've enjoyed the time with him.
As we sit here now, September 26th, who's your pick to play in and win the World Series?
Yeah, I can't be in the prediction game just because I stink at it. It's not that I'm trying to like run away from putting an opinion out there. I just suck at this. I was thinking about this last week because we were having the discussion on the air during our Red Sox Indians game, and you tend to kind of fall for the team that you're involved with that weekend. And as such, I was pretty high on the Indians. I think the world of Terry Francona as a leader and a game tactician. But, you know, if we were in Houston last weekend and I was immersed in that group talking to AJ Hinch and Brent Strom and that crazy young talented motor that they have, I'd probably be pushing the Astros. The answer is probably someplace in the American League. Let's put it that way. Cause I think the American League is stronger soup to nuts than the National League is. But again, we make these predictions and we are wrong almost every time.
If you were commissioner of baseball and you had absolute power to change the rules, what is the rule that you would change first?
Oh man, I love this one. Roster expansion is the blight of our game. 40 guys passionate on September rosters. I feel so strongly about this. It's archaic. It serves no greater purpose. If there's a blowout and you need to keep guys fresh, that's the only moment that you could use the extra pitching. But for the most part, if you give managers that many options, they're going to use them. Time of game, pace of play, it all goes south in September. The quality of play goes south. Not to mention, just from a big picture standpoint, how can you possibly change the rules in the final month of a six-month season right before the postseason? And if you want to really market our game and keep it in the foreground of younger fans in particular, when the NFL and college football has already kicked off, then you're going to run these crappy four-and-a-half-hour baseball games out there on national TV? You're simply fueling the fire of the pundits that say baseball is long and boring. You're just giving them all kinds of great fodder. So my suggestion is this, and it's easy, because the Players Association is concerned with preserving jobs. So you have a 40-man roster expansion where it counts towards service time, and that placates the Players Association. But on any given night, as they do in the NFL model with an active squad, you can only have 27 or 28 active players that night. So everybody gets their service time, but you don't have this huge cabinet full of choices.
Yeah, like Joe Maddon making four pitching changes in an inning last night. It was just ridiculous.
Uncle, in a six nothing game, it's so infuriating to me. You know, the example you would use is this. There was a game 2 years ago, first Sunday of the NFL season, and the Red Sox and Blue Jays played a 4-hour, 20-minute game in 9 innings with 18 pitchers. Ironically, on the first Sunday that the NFL kicked off, what kid is home watching that turd that couldn't be watching an NFL game that moves quick, that has a fantasy league component that's undeniably kept it as popular as it is? Baseball can't get out of its own way sometimes in figuring out ways to reinvent themselves. So, I know the commissioner's office is active about this, but the commissioner's office gets pushback on these things, if you can believe it. They got pushback on the mound visits edict, which was a very good, very, very productive change, albeit a small one, to our game. So there's people out there that don't want you to touch baseball, but I guarantee you the people that think it's perfect right now the way it is, they don't watch games on TV. They might go to a handful of games because when you go, it's a different experience sitting in the ballpark than if you're watching the game on TV. But the commissioner's office is in tune with a lot of this stuff, and they want to change it, and they get pushback, which is really a shame. The roster expansion thing stinks, and I can't for the life of me figure out why it wasn't addressed in the last negotiation with the Players Association.
That's a very fair point, and I think that a lot of people can get behind that. So you've been very gracious with your time, and I want to get you out of here on this. What did I not ask you that you wish that I'd asked you and you want to speak about now on this platform?
Oh, man. I was hoping we could get into favorite rock bands of all time and least favorite rock bands of all time. It's really, outside of baseball, it's the only other thing that I really care about.
All right, let's do it. Who's your favorite? Who's your least favorite?
I don't know. I'm on a thing right now where I think that Kiss is a dramatically overrated band. I used to love Kiss as a kid, but I went to a Halloween concert that Kiss had at Dodger Stadium in 98, and I think about it, and it was just all fireworks and makeup, and I don't know why, but at this moment, I'm a little aggravated over Kiss. And by that same token, I can't get enough listening to the band, and it's one of my only regrets in life is I did not see one of Levon Helm's concerts at his farmhouse in upstate New York before he passed away, because Levon Helm is my musical hero and I love the band and I can't get enough of it. So thanks for giving me that opportunity.
Thank you for coming on, Matt. Once again, that's Matt Vasgersian. He's the lead play-by-play announcer for ESPN's Sunday Night Baseball package. They will be broadcasting the wild card game on Tuesday night on ESPN, and we may not find out which teams are playing in it until Monday.
You got it. Ryan, good talking to you, man.
Such a stranger.